Does putting your child to bed on time have any benefits?
Treating an inflammation of the sac that surrounds your heart, pericarditis.
How often do weak spots in the blood vessels in the brain occur?
And probiotics for the prevention of antibiotic-associated diarrhea.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 18th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
So I'm going to apologize to our listeners up front because, gosh, we've got some pretty complicated things we were trying to get across in our promos today. I'd like to start first, because I stumbled all over it, about blood vessel weaknesses in the brain, otherwise known as aneurysms, and how prevalent they really are. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
This aneurysm is a weak spot in the blood vessel that, as you mentioned, can bulge out, and under certain circumstances, it can actually rupture and cause significant brain damage. So this study addressed the issue of how common do adults have unruptured brain aneurysms. So they took almost 5,000 adults aged 35 to 75 and did magnetic resonance angiography. By the way, this is one of the more sensitive ways of looking for these. And what they determined was that unruptured brain aneurysms were present in 7% of the people that were screened. 5.5% of men had unruptured brain aneurysms, and 8.4% of women. About 90% were less than 1/4 inch in diameter, which makes them very unlikely to rupture. It was estimated that only about 8.7% of these were actually those that were at a higher risk for rupturing.
Of course, we know that these kinds of weaknesses in vessel walls develop in lots of places. I specifically refer to the abdominal aortic aneurysm, something that the Surgeon General brought to everybody's attention and said, hey, we ought to really be thinking about this stuff and screening for it. So I guess I'd have to say, what really is the practical import of even looking for these things? Also, we know that the majority of strokes are not because of hemorrhages or ruptures of these things. They're due to thrombosis.
One of the things I think is important for our listeners to know is that there are certain major risk factors, some of which are under our control. Hypertension, high blood pressure, smoking, drinking, they're all major risk factors, and we can actually control those. I think it's important to know what the prevalence is, because oftentimes, as people are getting MRIs, now they'll be able to detect these, and we say, gosh, is this common or uncommon? And just as importantly, should anything in particular be done about it?
Right. So an interesting anatomical observation, and we'll see what happens from there. Since we're talking about anatomy, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. You framed it up as the sac surrounding the heart, that's the pericardium, and something called colchicine for inflammation of that particular part of the anatomy.
A large number of individuals develop inflammation of the sac that surrounds the heart, so-called pericarditis. It's usually thought to be due to a viral illness. The manifestations are it can cause very severe chest discomfort, worse when someone lies down and better when they sit up. It can be associated with some abnormal physical exam findings, a very scratchy sound that a doctor can hear with a stethoscope, and even some EKG abnormalities. And although it's not usually a significant problem, 90 to 95% of people recover without any sequelae, it's really painful. And the question is how to treat it. It can recur in as many as 40% of individuals. So this was a study that took 240 patients that had acute pericarditis. They all received typical anti-inflammatory medications like aspirin or ibuprofen. Then half of them were also randomized to colchicine, another anti-inflammatory medication, or to placebo. And they followed these individuals to see if it helped them to resolve faster and also to prevent recurrent pericarditis. And what they discovered was that recurrent pericarditis occurred in about 40% of individuals treated with placebo and only in about 17% of individuals that were treated with colchicine in addition to the anti-inflammatory medications. Not only did colchicine reduce the rate of recurrent pericarditis, but it reduced the number of recurrences and prolonged the time to recurrence as well.
Well, what's the downside to using colchicine?
First of all, I should say that it shouldn't be used in pregnant women because it may have some effects on the fetus. It can cause diarrhea if given in large doses, but interestingly, in the dose used in this study, the incidence of diarrhea was no different with colchicine as it was with placebo. So I think this ought to be the standard of care now for treating acute pericarditis. People get either high-dose aspirin and ibuprofen and colchicine as well.
Okay. Let's turn then to something else that's got some pretty significant practical import, I think. That's in the journal Pediatrics. And what this is something I found really fascinating. Of course, my kids have aged out of this particular issue at this point. But the impact of irregular bedtimes on the behavior of children.
What it did was try to examine whether non-clinical irregular sleep habits influence behavior. We know that kids that have a clinical diagnosis of sleep disorder have an increased risk of behavioral abnormalities. So what these investigators asked was, well, gosh, does having non-regular bedtimes influence the behavior of children? They looked at over 10,000 7-year-olds from the United Kingdom in which they had collected information regarding their bedtimes at 3, 5, and 7 years of age, and also assessed whether they had behavioral difficulties as rated by the parents and by the teachers. And what they discovered was that children that had non-regular bedtimes had more behavioral difficulties, and there was a clear dose response. Furthermore, if early on kids had regular bedtimes and then moved to non-regular bedtimes, they had a higher incidence of developing behavioral abnormalities, and vice versa. Children that had non-regular bedtimes, later, if they became regular, they decreased the incidence of behavioral abnormalities. So this suggests that having regular bedtimes during early childhood is an important influence on children's behavior.
Well, I really love this. My pediatrician for my daughters was a woman who had graduated from Johns Hopkins, and she was quite a taskmaster. She really believed in regulating one's children as much as possible. And I have to say that I was always happy to put the kids to bed because I needed some time for myself. So this seems like a really simple strategy that parents can implement in order to help improve their children's behavior.
And there are some plausible mechanisms behind it. We know that children have what are called circadian rhythms. Hormones are secreted during certain parts of the day. When you don't have regular sleep cycles, you interrupt those circadian rhythms. We also know that sleep is a lot of time where memory is embedded in the brain. And so children that have irregular sleep times really may not have the same brain maturation.
I would also add that, of course, for adults, we know, too, that both adequate sleep and regular sleep habits are important in maintaining health. So I would advocate that for you, knowing that you, A, don't sleep very much, and B, are rather stochastic, and when you try to grab some of those Z's. Finally, then, let's turn to something that's rather disappointing. That's in The Lancet, and that is the utility of lactobacillus, pretty common bacterium that's found in yogurt often, and its ability to prevent Clostridium difficile, a very, very important, often nosocomial infection.
While you tee this up as being disappointing, I actually like this study because it addresses one of the major issues we have. We oftentimes have small single-center studies that point us in a certain direction to try to figure out whether a treatment is effective. We oftentimes combine these in a meta-analysis to come to what I'm going to call a meta-conclusion. What we need is properly conducted trials to nail down whether a therapy is effective or not, and that's exactly what this is. Antibiotic-associated diarrhea affects about 20% of individuals that are placed on antibiotics. And as you mentioned, one of the most notorious effectors is C. diff. So what this study did was they took almost 3,000 older inpatients. These are individuals over the age of 65 who were exposed to one or more parenteral antibiotics, parenteral meaning they received them intravenously. And these individuals were randomized to either receive placebo or a preparation of lactobacilli and bifidobacteria to the tune of about 60 billion organisms one day for 21 days. And they assessed whether or not the probiotic could decrease antibiotic-associated diarrhea. In those that received placebo, about 10.4% develop antibiotic-associated diarrhea, and those that received the probiotic, 10.8%. So it really was not effective. Furthermore, when they looked at antibiotic-associated diarrhea due to Clostridium, there was no difference between the two treatments arms. It's disappointing that it didn't affect antibiotic-associated diarrhea, but it really gives us a firm answer about whether these probiotics are beneficial or not.
So, of course, this brings to mind, at least for me, this idea of the microbiome and whether one can modify one's microbiome with oral supplementation and whether that's not kind of a good idea prophylactically early in life before the potential for becoming infected with something like C. diff exists.
Clearly, our microbiome influences our immune status and our resistance to organisms. What we need to do is to try to find ways to maintain that microbiome to decrease those risks.
So I guess we're going to turn back to fecal transplants then in order to deal with this intractable problem, something that we do have a lot of pretty persuasive data on. On that note then, I'm going to say that this week I'm going to do the bedtimes for kids in the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live and sleep well.